Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world all around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating and so on. Coming up in this week's programme, we're going to be talking about some fascinating research that is attempting to do the impossible when it comes to crime scene investigations. And that is to recover fingerprints from a spent bullet. Irish scientists are involved. We'll get to that in a bit. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at @newstalkscience. First up, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Shelley Brady from DCU and Dr. Laura Hayes from the Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies. You're both very welcome back to this. Good to see you back in studio. We'll start off with you, Laura, and we've been talking quite a lot about various things that we need to do to try and slow down climate change and global warming. And one of the things that's come up quite a bit is to just, what if we just throw some dust in the air and block out the sun?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this almost sounds something like from, you know, that is not actually real, right? So some future kind of film idea, right? But this is geoengineering, that we want to reduce the heat of the earth by blocking out the sun, throwing some dust up there. So this whole idea is looking at stratospheric aerosol injection, where basically you put things up there to block out the sun. And it's kind of inspired by volcanoes, right? When you have a big volcanic eruption that puts loads of sulfites into the atmosphere.
Like Eyjafjallajökull.
Say again?
Like Eyjafjallajökull, which is the absolute wrong way to pronounce that Icelandic eruption.
Okay. I don't think I've ever heard that out loud, but there you go.
No, well, it's absolutely 100% as incorrect as it goes.
Okay. Well, there is, I'm going to make a bad pronunciation as well, but there was Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines in 1991 was a very large volcano eruption and actually reduced the temperature of the earth by 0.5 degrees, right? So this whole idea, like maybe we can put a load of things up there and block out the sunlight and reduce the earth and basically pull the handbrake on, this emergency handbrake on global warming, fix the problem with an easy fix. However, in theory, that makes sense. But this kind of study done by Columbia University showed when you actually go and practically try to do that, good luck, right? It's really, really hard from an engineering point of view, from a cost point of view, and then also from a geopolitical point of view.
Okay, so let's go through them one by one, please.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, so in theory, you can say if you put an absolute perfectly distribution things of dust around the earth, and very kind of evenly distributed, it works, but this is idealized simulations, right? But this study looked at, okay, well, first of all, how do you get all of that dust and particles up there? If you put sulfites up there, maybe we could do it. But this has also other impacts. It can infect weather. It can reduce the ozone. So they also looked at, okay, well, what other things can you put up there? So they looked at putting up different types of particles, such as calcium carbonate, and even tiny, tiny grains of diamonds, so diamonds in the sky. But then you really start having a problem, yeah. Well, it costs a lot of money to put a load of diamonds in the sky. So this is also becoming very impractical.
Who was it, Liberace working on this project or what?
I don't know, someone had stars in their eyes. So this is really challenging. Right, then it's also you have to make these particles really, really small. They can start to clump together and fall down, and that's not necessarily what we want. And then it's a question of how do you make them distributed equally around the Earth, right? We have to get all the nations together to all decide to put diamonds into space. And this is, of course, then really, really challenging. We can't agree on even reducing our carbon emissions, right? How are we going to agree on putting these particles all around space?
We could just have an Ireland-shaped cloud over Ireland. I mean, it wouldn't have zero effect on our weather, I would imagine.
Yeah, maybe you could do something, I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, but then I guess you have to really think about, you know, this butterfly effect. You know, what do we do if, how do we make sure that it doesn't have a knock-on effect and impact weather patterns in different parts of the world?
I mean, let's just following that thread for a moment, right? If we look at America, last time I checked, it was five times the average consumption of energy per person in the United States. So other nations, five times as much in America. If they are doing that and that has an effect on our entire globe, I mean, geopolitically, could we not do this and say, look, you're doing that, we're doing this? I mean, like...
Yeah, I guess the whole problem is that, you know, we think of country by country, but, you know, we are a very small planet in a solar system orbiting a very large sun. So we really have to do this looking as one planet.
Yeah.
So we have to make sure it goes equally distributed around the whole world for this actually to work, to block out some of that sun. I think, you know, it's kind of impractical, risky, expensive, kind of works, but, you know, maybe we need to just think of other ways to do this.
I believe people are doing that.
Yeah,
I believe
for sure,
people
for
are
sure.
doing that. And at least this as a concept, although, look, and people can say, I can't believe you're going there. We should reduce this. We should reduce that. Yeah, good luck convincing the world to stop going in the direction it's going. This, at least we know in theory, works because we have previous examples of it. It's hard, but then so was going to the moon at the time. My second story has to do with the retina.
Yeah, so this research, it's all about tackling age-related macular degeneration. So that affects the central part of the retina, so your central vision ultimately. So it makes activities like reading and driving and recognizing faces difficult, but you still have your peripheral or your side vision.
Not all at the same time, obviously.
Yeah, so it preserves your ability to walk around without bumping into things. And this is a reality for millions of people worldwide, and it's actually one of the leading causes of visual impairment in adults. So scientists at University College London and the Moorfields Eye Hospital have found a way to bring back some of that lost sight. And they've done a small trial, so just 38 people. And what they've actually done is put a tiny electronic implant under the centre of the retina, below the cells that had died. And this chip, it's absolutely amazing stuff. This chip is wirelessly connected to a pair of augmented reality glasses that's attached to small computers, which is worn around the waistband of the person. And it's called the Prima system, and it uses a video camera in the glasses. It captures the images of the text. The glasses then project that image as infrared light onto the implanted chip, and then the chip converts the light into electrical signals, which the brain can then interpret as vision. So it's absolutely amazing.
Wow.
And it's unreal. And they were able to restore meaningful central vision for 80% of the patients. So nothing like this has ever been done before.
So just walk me through the apparatus again.
Yeah. So a tiny implant, so it's really tiny, was placed under the center of the retina. So
and is that connected to a wire or is it wireless?
It's totally wireless. So they were put under those cells that had died in the retina. And this chip is wireless, and that's what connects to the glasses, so these augmented reality glasses. And they're attached, again, wirelessly to a small computer, which the individual wears on their waistband. So it's absolutely unreal. And what the video, so the video camera then captures what the person should be seeing, and then that image is projected back as infrared light onto the chip. And then that's what the person can then interpret as vision.
But how do they connect? How do they connect the... you know, the brain recognizing, you know, because obviously perception happens in the brain. How do they connect these signals into something meaningful in the brain? Is it, does it take time to habituate to the brain figuring out what these signals are when they're coming in?
Yeah, exactly. So ultimately, it's creating, it's like a small patch of artificial central vision. And that's layered with whatever natural peripheral vision that person still had. And the participants in the study, they actually underwent several months of training to learn to read using this new device. And they described it as a new way of looking through their eyes. So it wasn't simple learning to read again through them. It took several months for them to become proficient. But for many, so 80% of them, when they did that, it meant being able to read things like signs and menus and text messages. And there's even a zoom function on the camera so that they could zoom in and read fine print text like a prescription.
Yeah, that is incredible. And so what they're seeing is a composite of this of these two inputs, the what's left of their eye plus the chip together, and their brains essentially creating some sort of reality by taking in those two inputs.
Exactly. And it's not perfect. They said it themselves. The restored vision, it's only black and white, very high contrast, not detailed enough to recognize faces. But it's a huge step forward. Mm. And who knows what the future iterations could, like, it's only going to get better and better, I would imagine, and it could become a real solution for this cohort of people.
Extraordinary. Thank you so much for that, Shelley. Laura, our third story has to do with the COVID vaccine. I think it's been long enough. We can actually breathe again and talk about COVID. So the COVID vaccine, highly controversial at the time, still highly controversial in certain parts of the world. What is this story?
Yes, this is a really interesting story. And actually reading it brought me back to all these thoughts about, you know, COVID vaccines, the Pfizer's versus the Moderna and all of this. So basically, this is a really interesting new study that showed that COVID-19 vaccines, specifically the mRNA vaccines, so this is the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines, can boost the effectiveness of cancer immunotherapy, right? So they saw that patients that use are on immunotherapy for cancer treatments. So this is a type of treatment that helps your immune system recognize and attack tumors. They found that patients that were on this therapy and also had the COVID-19 vaccine within 100 days significantly helped the recovery and also significantly showed that they lived longer. So, for example, they looked at patients with lung cancers and melanoma, and they said, again, within having this treatment and just a COVID vaccine, their three-year survival rate went from 30% to 50%. That's a really large jump in survival rates.
Yeah.
And even for the study with lung cancer patients, they have an average survival rate of 27 months, and they're still doing the statistics because they don't have an average survival rate of those patients that also had that COVID-19 vaccine. So this was really interesting. And what it's actually kind of showing is that these COVID vaccines don't just teach your body to fight the coronavirus. So basically, when you have your COVID-19 vaccine, it allows your immunotherapy to be more effective. And how that basically works is that a lot of the time with this immunotherapy, your immune system needs to recognize those tumors. And sometimes it just doesn't see these tumors, right? So your immune system needs to see them. A lot of the time it doesn't. Immunotherapy doesn't work. But basically, the COVID-19 vaccine basically is like a torch that's shining lights on all these vaccines so that now this immunotherapy can actually go in and act as it should.
Wow, that's very interesting. And so they have to have had the COVID vaccine within 100 days. It needs to be a fresh COVID vaccine, so like a booster or the annual, like a flu vaccine or whatever. Was there any data as to whether or not a flu vaccine was also as effective, also helpful or no?
Yeah, absolutely. So they did look at patients also that had a flu vaccine or the pneumonia vaccine, and they found that didn't have any significant impact whatsoever.
Right, so specifically mRNA vaccines.
Specifically okay. mRNA
vaccines. Very interesting. All right, our final story has to do with pigs. Poor pigs, they get a lot of experimentation, don't they? This is gene editing of pigs. For what reason exactly, Shelley?
Yeah, so we're looking at viruses again here with this piece of research, but it's instead of in humans, it's in pigs. And instead of looking at vaccinations and their effect, it's looking at gene editing. So in Edinburgh at the Roslin Institute, which is the same centre that gave us Dolly the sheep, researchers are using gene editing to create pigs that are resistant to a deadly virus called classical swine fever. Now, this is a devastating livestock disease. It's been eradicated in Ireland since the 50s and in the UK since the 60s, but it does continue to pose a major threat worldwide to pig farming. It spreads really quickly. Outbreaks lead to mass culling. Humans aren't affected, but it does cost farmers and economies billions every year.
And we know, flus in general are very capable of species jumping. And so while swine flu isn't necessarily a problem now for humans, give it, 50 different iterations, it might be.
Who knows? Exactly. And vaccines do exist for this, but they're really hard to use effectively in those large-scale commercial farming situations, especially in areas where the disease does remain endemic. So at Roslin, what they've decided to do is take a different approach, and they are changing the pigs themselves rather than fighting the virus after infection. So they're using CRISPR gene editing, and what they've done is they've targeted a gene called DNAJC14, and the virus needs this in order to replicate. And they've subtly altered the gene, and they've made it impossible for the virus to hijack the pig cells. So it's a small trial. Only four gene-edited pigs were directly exposed to the virus. None of them got sick, but their unedited counterparts, it sounds so strange to call a pig unedited, but their unedited counterparts, they all developed the full-blown symptoms. So these pigs, they're not vaccinated, they're genetically immune.
Right. I mean, I suppose the end goal of this is what?
Well, what they're hoping to do is increase welfare. So reduce illness and suffering. This is what they're saying, reduce illness and suffering in the animals. It's quite timely, though, because it's really interesting. A lot of countries are starting to relax rules around gene editing in agriculture.
Are they?
Yeah. And the UK has a Precision Breeding Act, and they're kind of paving the way for gene edited crops. But in the US, Japan and Brazil, I believe, they've already approved gene-edited livestock and generated pigs, which are resistant to a different virus to this one. And they've been approved for sale in the US. And
have they?
Yeah, they're expecting them to go on the market in 2026.
I wonder what the labelling is around that. It'll be very interesting to see when they hit the shelves. That's really interesting. Thank you so much, Dr. Shelley Bailey from DCU and Dr. Laura Hayes from the Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies. Thank you so much for your time. Imagine a crime scene. Spent bullet casings scattered across the floor, a murder victim and the perpetrator at large. For decades, forensic experts have struggled to recover fingerprints from bullet casings because of the intense heat of gunfire. But that might be about to change. Joining me now is Dr. Colin McKeever's assistant lecturer and researcher in analytical chemistry at the Department of Pharmaceutical Sciences and Biotechnology at TUS. Welcome to the programme, Colin.
Cheers. Thanks a million for having me.
Tell me a little bit about this research. Were you specifically looking at bullet casings to start off with, or were you just interested in chemical and thermal reactions?
So the initial idea was to focus on visualizing fingerprints. So with that, the background of it would be to look towards those bullet casings. Now, we did manage to eventually put towards our bullet casings, but we had to start understanding how the chemistry might interact with the material that bullet casings are made of. So we started out with visualizing fingerprints on just simple brass, because that's the most common type of material that bullet casings are made of. And a lot of interesting things popped up with the chemistry of brass and how we applied our material to the surface in the hopes of visualizing our fingerprints that were applied.
So talk to me about what a fingerprint is exactly.
Yeah, so a fingerprint is those ridges that are on the tips of your fingers, obviously. But fingerprints form at birth, and that's kind of the reason why we have this unique identifier. Some people might claim that your fingerprints are a random kind of movement in the womb as the fingers are being grown by the fetus. But fingerprints themselves are the physical characteristics at the tip of your finger. Now, what we were looking at is what we might call finger marks. So that's once the fingerprint has touched a surface, residues are left behind. So those residues are about 98% water, like your sweat or any kind of minerals that might be coming out. But some of it is kind of that kind of oily sebaceous glands, and that's usually what is left behind. So the fingerprints that we're focusing on, or the finger marks that we're focusing on, are latent prints. And anyone can generate a latent print themselves quite easily. Just rub your finger along your nose and touch your smartphone, and there's a fingerprint left over. So those were the kind of latent prints that we were focusing on.
So all my life, I've been calling finger marks fingerprints.
Yeah, it was something that I had to get used to
right as
well. The fingerprint is on the finger and a finger mark is left behind.
Right, okay. So we often see this in CSI, or if you get, as we were broken into, they come with a duster and so on. And what they're doing is they're trying to visualize, as you say, this oily substance that we excrete, sweat or whatever, that forms along the ridges of your fingerprint. And if you manage to capture that, it gives people a very clear idea. So when it comes to a bullet, though, we're talking about something that undergoes an enormous physical stress. Talk to me about what happens inside a gun and how that affects the temperature and the heat and the shape of a brass casing.
Yeah, so the general makeup of a bullet or ammunition itself is you have the bullet at the top, which is what is fired, and then inside the casing is a mixture of propellants. So simplify it down, it's explosive material.
It's like there's a pointy bit, kind of like a Pope's hat at the top, and then not a Pope's hat, a bishop's hat. I don't know. Anyway, a pointy hat on it, and then. A cardinal, maybe, yeah. Thanks, Maurice. And then there's a little cap thing that fires it, right? Is there anything else apart from those two things?
So in the actual casing itself, it's a hollow tube that's filled with what we call propellant. So that's explosive material. So once the hammer of the gun hits the cap of the bullet, you get this little spark and all of the explosive material in there explodes, firing the bullet forward. Now, when it comes to temperatures and pressures, obviously the pressure has to be very high to fire this bullet quite far and quite fast. Temperature-wise, it's hard to determine exactly what temperatures are going to be present inside the barrel of the gun, but air estimations were about at least 700 degrees Celsius.
Wow.
And if it could be more with higher caliber ammunition then as well. So we're talking like the 50 caliber sniper rifles, they might be able to get up to maybe 1100 degrees.
Okay, so I would have imagined that if we're talking about oil or water or anything that isn't, you know, mineral in nature, that is going to be completely vaporized. Why did you think this might be possible? And how did you go about determining whether or not it was?
So while the water might be completely removed from the surface with this intense heat, what's actually might be left behind is the oily kind of secretions that are left. So they're generally made up of material that's capable of burning. So the idea would be that hopefully any of this sweat, like this oily secretion that's left behind, would burn onto the surface. And air hopes was that in a traditional print where you'd hope this oily secretion is, and you stick your material to that oily secretion, for air method, we were kind of hoping that this burnt material that's left behind will act almost as a stencil protecting the surface of the ammunition casing. So the method itself was to deposit material on the surface, and it's a highly contrast colored material. So what we were doing was any part of the surface that didn't change color came in contact, and we called that a negative print. So the fingerprint or finger mark itself, yeah, I'm doing it now, but the finger mark itself is actually protecting the surface from air deposition of material. And it's this change in color that we were hoping to see to visualize that finger mark.
Cool. So what, you put it in an oven or something, or were you able to recreate the pressure and heat of a barrel?
Yeah. So we managed to, just with the kind of preliminary studies, we managed to get a sheet of brass and we applied this finger mark to the surface and placed it inside a furnace. So the furnace was heated up then to 700 degrees and we left it in there for about 20 seconds, which is far longer than the heat would be in the barrel for. So in the barrel, it would jump up really high and cool down quite quickly. So we went kind of quite more drastic in terms of the actual temperature degradation. And under those controlled studies, we could still get good visualization of the finger mark. We unfortunately weren't able to fire a bullet and test it, but under that kind of controlled experimental conditions, the method still held up.
That's amazing. So the next test, I suppose, is using live ammunition. Have you not got to that stage yet?
No. So obviously, Ireland doesn't have a huge gun culture, so acquiring such...
Let's keep it that way, shall we?
100%, 100%. But getting this type of evidence, or at least samples of this evidence, is quite hard. So we're trying, but we'll have to go through law professions in order to get kind of working on the next phase of the project. I think the idea around it is that, so Forensic Science Ireland, I won't comment too much on it, but they have a department called the Technical Bureau, and these are the scientist guards. And these people would be in control of generating the actual evidence itself for
us. Okay.
So under complete strict conditions in the firing range, and then hopefully the evidence would be sent on to me for that control testing.
Okay, so you have a request in to get someone to, you know, hold a brass bullet, load it, fire it, and then keep that in an evidence bag. Is that ideally what you're looking for?
Well, like that would be the kind of next steps towards it. I wouldn't want to put myself too far ahead, you know.
Yeah.
Before Atten's confirmed, but that would be the next goal of getting law enforcement involved to aim towards use case samples, we'll say.
Okay. And so what you're essentially looking of for is sort of the sebum that's been burnt and leaves that residue on the brass.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. In terms of the United States and, you know, obviously the federal agencies over there, has this work not been done before?
So it's been done to minor extent. In a lot of cases, people just thought it was a lost cause. Because of the current methods of visualization, you're hoping for that sticky residue to remain on the surface. With new developments in terms of like my space of chemistry, where we kind of focus on electrochemistry, we have this chance of essentially turning the bullet into an electrode. So chemical reactions can happen directly on the surface in a very controlled manner, as opposed to reactions happening around the print and hopefully something sticking to it. We can do it on the minute surface chemistry scale. So it's more so that the technology has developed to a point where we can actually start looking at this.
Amazing.
But it is something that people really want to look for.
And the finger marks that you got with your experiments, were they? Would you be able to identify the perp with them? See, I'm doing the talk.
Well, yeah, firstly, they're all mine. So
oh, right,
yeah,
okay. I definitely wouldn't be. It's a very short whodunit.
yeah. But in terms of the actual quality of the finger mark itself, yeah, so we managed to get some of the highest possible detail of visualization of that finger mark. In some cases, we got such high definition, we were able to see the sweat pores on the finger mark ridges, like of the fingerprint ridges. So we could get really, really minute details at the surface. And with the end goal of any type of fingerprint visualization, you're hoping to get that nice picture at the end.
Yeah.
So we managed to get that really nice picture at the end.
I mean, obviously, one way around it is just to wear gloves when loading the gun. Have you thought about that?
Yeah, I suppose that's what any new kind of forensic development of a method of any description. But when it comes around to firearm generated evidence in general, you have your three main pillars where you're looking for your tool mark evidence to match the bullet back to the gun itself. You're looking for your gunshot residue evidence to match at least someone who was close to the gun after it was fired. And then hopefully we'll involve Erwin to the point where you might be able to say who loaded the gun. So really the idea is it's an extra quiver in the arrow of forensic professionals. Yeah, people can get around this. They've been doing it with finger marks themselves. You've seen it in multiple crime shows where people wipe down the steering wheel after they leave.
I mean, I think it's very, very worthwhile to investigate. Do you go to like forensic conventions as part of your work now? Like, would you go to like conferences where people are showing off their like essentially spy gadgets to catch the bad guys?
Unfortunately, I haven't aimed in that direction.
Sorry, I'm such an immature man. Like, honestly, I'm such a child. I'm like imagining you walking around and some person's like Q from 007. No, this is what we do here. Right, sorry. I've let my imagination run away with me and we're supposed to be talking about science. Really interesting work. Let's hope you get those bullets. Come back to us if you do. Thanks, Colm.
Well, thanks a million.
No. Cheers. That's Colm McKeever. He's an assistant lecturer and researcher in analytical chemistry at TUS. All right, time to look back at some of your comments from last week. We were talking about pregnant women and why they get morning sickness, and it might be a clever immunological reaction, is what Professor Molly Fox of UCLA was saying. Georgie says, I was interested in your consideration of the baby immune system during the pregnancy. It got me wondering, how might early immune signaling between fetus and mother influence risks for allergies or infections after birth? Good question. I don't think we know the answer to that. Another person says, could fetal immune cells be leveraged therapeutically to improve outcomes in complicated pregnancies like preeclampsia? I think there is some work being done on that. There is some promise of some studies, but we're just not anywhere close to having clinical trials, let alone something that you can actually use in clinic, I'm afraid. We also talked about supplement quality, but Professor John Nolan. Johnny says, if some products degrade rapidly, even if they contain the correct ingredients at manufacture, what does this mean for effectiveness? Well, I mean, that was the entire point of John's interview, really, Johnny, that, you know, to even if you got the product just as it was being manufactured, you know, a lot of the times as they come out of the packet, they apparently do not always have the ingredients in the amounts they are supposed to, let alone are they then effective in the body? Because how we consume vitamins doesn't necessarily mean those vitamins get to where they're supposed to get, unfortunately. And Vera says, what separates a good omega-3 supplement from a poor one? Well, I mean, for me, I would have imagined, you know, where is it coming from? What are the raw ingredients? And if you are, you know, if you're taking, you know, cod liver oil that's directly in capsule, or if you're taking, you know, fresh fish, that to me would imagine to be a best and most natural source. One of the things that John said is, you know, the more we farm and mass produce these things, the more difficult it is to extract high quality nutrients from them. He was talking specifically about, you know, farming, but I imagine that the same is true of raw ingredients like fish and so on. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galvin, and Hugo De Silva Scott on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.